friends. Welcome. It is 4 p.m. Central Time, or thereabouts, after the news break, that is. And you're listening to me on the great GCN Radio Network, either online or through one of our great GCN Radio affiliates. In any case, friends, that means it's now time for INN World Report Radio. Thank you so much for tuning in. We're here now Monday through Friday on GCN at the same time period, 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time. And we've got a great show lined up for you today. We're going to start focusing, friends, on a topic that I think is becoming increasingly more important all the time. It was just one of these things that any thinking person could see would be coming down the road eventually. And due to the fact that our oligarchy, our elites, have so totally shifted from reality that we've really put a dent into our economic situation, into our governmental situation, and so forth. We're getting relatively weaker. At the same time, the People's Republic of China is getting increasingly much stronger every day by leaps and bounds, a giant for sure that is waking up, a giant that we helped wake up for certain when Richard Nixon opened the door to U.S. corporations dealing with China. And so in that spirit, I think it's a time that we start taking a look at this dynamic and paying more attention to it. So for the next two programs, we're going to focus on it. Today, our guest is going to be James Norman, and he'll be joining us in a few more minutes. He, another one of the Trine Day authors that I'm trying to feature because the information is so interesting. He wrote a book in 2008 called The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century, and he puts forth a very, very interesting proposition that oil prices, far from it being a free market, are manipulated all the time. And the price was driven down in the 80s to break the back of the Soviet Union. And now that that has been accomplished and China is needing more and more oil every day, the price has been driven up to give the Chinese a hard time. Very, very interesting concept. So we'll be speaking with James in just a few more minutes. And then also, tomorrow we're going to be joined by Professor Doug Guthrie from New York University Stern School of Business, right about a mile away from here. And he's a China expert as well. So for the next two programs, we're going to be talking about the onslaught, the oncoming of China, and what does it mean, and how, you know, what kind of craziness can we find ourselves wrapped up in as our elites react to it, and hopefully don't do anything stupid. But in any case, before we continue with the program, I'd like to say hello again to Karen, who's a caller who's on the line. Karen called in last week from Oregon, and Karen has joined us again at the beginning of the program to talk about this this concept that she's been putting forward about a national day of protest, a national day of strike. Karen, is that what it is?
Actually, it's a national strike encompassing 4 days, from Thursday, April 15th through Sunday, April 18th, with some of us carrying it over one more day for the 19th to go to our state capitals and present our so-called officials with our letters of petitions, with our articles of freedom that are signed. So it's a total, complete strike for all Americans out there, and it would be wonderful if it could even go international. But we're focusing on restoring the Constitution and coming together, reaching out across all boundaries, because this is an issue that is about all of the people.
Well, do you have a website or something put up yet that people can go to find out more about it?
I do. The website is taxfree15.com. That's taxfree, the number 15.com. It can also be accessed by the 15th if people want to put the TH on the end of it. That'll reach us, too. And the site is being updated because we are really starting to link up with all the organizations up there. And one thing, too, Tom, I wanted to say that we've started to call, you mentioned the elite. We're starting to call them the dominant criminal minority because that's power.
Karen, and I say that they're bent on implementing neo-feudalism to drive everybody back to the feudal age.
They're bent, period. They're bent and twisted, and it's time that we got them out of there.
Well, that's true, and by definition, I think they are very small in number. numerically, and almost therefore yet the power that they wield is very, very disproportionate to their numbers. So by definition, practically, I think they have to operate in secret for the most part, or at least what their aims are, lest they be run out of town, or lest they inspire a second French Revolution.
Well, that might be on the way, but to me, I just get real tired of thinking about them as elite or the black nobility, because there's nothing elite or noble about them. Right now, they're just a dominant criminal minority, and it's empowering for me to think of it in those terms because it reduces them to the criminals who they really are. This is a mafia-type organization seeking to take over the world, and we the people must stand as one and come together and totally, peacefully, collectively withdraw our support financially, and also no work, no school. We got it all lined up there at taxfree15.com.
Well, you don't mind if I come on the air that day, do you?
No, I would love you to come on the air that day.
Some people are tax exempt, tax protest exempt, I suppose.
Well, it's about everybody being able to do what they can. Now, some people who work in hospitals won't be able to take the time off, but they can pull their money out of the banks. They can call up their representatives and give them a piece of their mind. And we're also working on an avenue to where during those days, we're going to see what we can do to have live interactive webinars so that people don't all have to go out of their homes to participate. This is about education. This is about empowerment. And this is about standing for freedom instead of sitting and allowing ourselves to be run over.
Well, I think it's a very lofty goal, and I wish you a lot of success. You've got plenty of time yet to sort of prepare for it, and I'd like you to come on the evening program on INN War Report. We run two shows a week at night on the Rule of Law Radio Network out of Austin, so you can come on tonight and talk a little bit more about it to that audience. I'm in favor of incremental things. I mean, bless you, for taking on such a large concept. I hope you can get a lot of success, but also I'd ask you to consider sort of more gradual things that people could do. I think you mentioned shifting your money out of large banks to smaller local banks and credit unions and so forth. I think it's very effective to target particular industries or industry leaders that take our money and then invest it against us in politicians and in advertising and in corporate media and so forth, and maybe sometimes it's easier for people to participate who may not be so bold as to take a big step like that, but when they go to the gas station, they can economically choose to go one place and not another, just for instance. What do you think of those ideas?
Well, I like those ideas, Tom, but at the same time, this new world order, which is actually the old world order and feudalism, is ramping up. There are rumors of a false flag, and people who think that they're not affected are mistaken. This affects each and every one of us, and the time for freedom without personal sacrifice has ended. We need to really take this by the reins. We need to be serious. And those of us right now who are listening who think, well, I couldn't possibly do that, I want to encourage you to watch America Freedom to Fashion, watch the Obama deception, watch the fall of the Republic. Turn off your television and start to really recognize that unless we, the people, come together, our descendants will only know freedom as a word that was heard in their distant past, because they'll be debt slaves. Well, they already are.
Well, we'll talk again tonight about this as well. I'd also like to hear your opinions on getting some we, the people, type candidates into office, but that'll have to be for another segment because we've got a guest coming up. James Norman will be joining us, friends, right on the other side of this break. We're going to be talking about the oil card.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central. For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming Top of the Hour Radio News Briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to INNWorldReport.net.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio. And as I was saying earlier, friends, I want to start focusing, use the resources that we have here on INN to educate ourselves about the new power dynamic that is now rapidly emerging in the world, I would say, and that is the coming online, particularly of the People's Republic of China, a major industrial power at this point and growing every day. And then you've also got the very large country, India, that is also waking up, another sleeping giant. Two very large countries that were really not contenders in, on the world stage economically, militarily for a very, very long time. And now they're coming online. And so in that spirit, we're joined right now for the first time on INN, I might add, by a fellow New Yorker, James Norman, who took stock of the situation and as it pertains to oil prices and so forth, came up with a very interesting thesis, and he has it in his book, The Oil Card. It's another one of the Trine Day books that I was telling you about. And Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. Jim is an oil reporter, I would say. Is that correct, Jim?
Yeah, spent a long time writing about the oil business.
Very good. Well, welcome to INN World Report. And why don't you tell our audience about the way you see these amazing fluctuations in the so-called free market in oil and what it means to you?
Yeah, Tom. Well, from being a reporter for a long time covering the oil industry, I just became very fascinated with this huge run-up in the price of oil that peaked in the middle of 2008. And as that was happening, I went back and looked at some of the history of oil pricing and what really drives these markets. As it turns out, there's a clear, strong paper trail that exists that shows that the U.S. government and its allies, for national security purposes, has a long history of moving the price of oil up and down to help and hurt our friends and enemies, and particularly it was in the 1980s, it was a concerted effort under the Reagan administration to drive down the price of oil to break the Soviet Union, and it worked. We busted those guys without firing a shot, and it was the drop in the price of crude that really did it, and the Russians themselves admit that's what killed us. When prices started to move up, actually it started at the end of the Clinton era. In the late 90s, prices started to move up for really no good reason amid a whole bunch of very odd government activities that were going on, including buying more crude for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, huge run-up in futures trading, unregulated. And so I started to look, well, it looks like there's exact opposite dynamic at work here, that the government wants this price to go up. And when you look at our deteriorating relationship with the People's Republic of China, you can see why. And so I just looked at this whole oil market dynamic in the context of economic warfare, and it's scary.
The People's Republic of China has over a billion people coming on strong. it reminds me so much of the quote that's attributed to Lenin, and as I understand it, there's not a lot of substance to back it up, but it's an interesting quote in any case where Lenin says, the capitalists will sell us the rope with which we'll hang them. I'm really determined. You're in New York. I want to make a big poster on the BQE, a billboard, you know, of Chairman Mao smiling at everybody, asking, got rope, you know? but they're notoriously short on oil and certain other raw materials to feed their incredible expansion that's going on. And then clearly at this rate, they're going to be the number one consumer of oil in the world, I would think. That's a weak spot for them, is it not?
Yes, they're extremely vulnerable. They're really naked on about half of their crude supply needs. They produce about half of their crude, but it's pretty junky stuff, really. They need light, sweet crude. They have to buy it mostly from our friends, the Saudis. They're buying a lot of it from Iran. They have to ship it halfway around the world. They pay top dollar for it. They refine it in rather unsophisticated refineries. They pay through the nose partly because they're buying it with an undervalued currency. You know, their currency is probably 30% undervalued.
Right, yuan, right? Yep.
Right. Whereas the United States, interestingly, we buy crude from our friends, the Canadians, the Mexicans, the Saudis. So the money that we spend abroad for crude, it actually stays in the family. In fact, these are states that we would be supporting in any case. And we're able to buy it with an overvalued currency. We ship it short haul into the United States. We process it with extremely sophisticated refineries. We get a lot of value added out of it. We can get along just fine at very high crude prices. Whereas for the Chinese, it's a severe drag for them.
Probably one of a few drags, but otherwise they really have the wind at their back, I think, with us buying everything we need from them these days. Another thing I noticed that was very interesting in your book, you really dispatched the notion of this peak oil situation that we're running out of oil. I mean, let's separate that from the pollution and global warming, which is a whole nother kettle of fish. But why don't you talk to our audience a little bit, Jim, about your observations as an oil man for such a long time about the potential oil reserves left in the world?
Well, if you talk to any real oil man, they will scoff at the idea that the Earth's crust is about to run out of oil anytime soon. In fact, we're finding more and more of this stuff all the time. There's been like a dozen supergiant fields found just in the last couple of years. As we drill deeper, we're finding large deposits of light, sweet crude at depths far below any fossil material. It's not a fossil fuel. It's just created internally in the Earth's crust.
That was another fascinating idea put forth in your book. I thought, you know, everything you know is wrong.
Idea.
You know, no, for me it was new to me there that the idea that this is decayed plant life and animal life may not be the case at all.
Right. No, it the Earth is generating hydrogen and carbon. There's carbon in the surface, and it generates hydrogen and other gases internally. As the Earth kind of grinds away inside, as this stuff comes up to the surface, it gets cooked into long chains of hydrocarbons. And wherever there's porous rock, that stuff will collect. And so it's just a matter of drilling the holes to find it. And plus, there's a huge amount of oil that's already been found. We know where it is. It just hasn't been economic to lift it out of the ground until now. But technology is relentless, and we're finding new ways to work old oil fields. We got oil. We have oil coming out of our ears. There's no reason for crude oil to be over $80 a barrel right now.
Yeah, so why don't we come back to that point? That's what got you started on your quest to understand the dynamics here. Why the heck is the price so high when we've got it coming out of our ears? But that could probably be said for a lot of other commodities as well. Anyhow, friends, we're talking with Jim Norman, a longtime oil reporter, about his great book, The Oil Card, and a very, very interesting thesis that he puts forward. We'll be right back with him after this. We'll be right back. right, good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio, Monday through Friday, right here on the great GCN Radio Network, 4 until 5 p.m. And, you know, INN is dedicated to bringing you the news the networks won't tell you, real news the networks won't tell you. And if the networks happen to be covering a topic that we are focusing on, you can bet that we will bring it to you from an angle, that from a place where they dare not go. And in that spirit, we're joined today by James Norman, James R. Norman, an oil writer for quite a long time, and he's got another one of these trying day books out that we're focusing on, The Oil Card, and a very, very interesting thesis about the so-called free market and why it's acting, Jim, would you say, backwards, right?
Yes, right, in defiance of gravity, you could say.
And give our audience a few more examples of this. What, you know, why the price of oil should be a lot lower than it is now. We seem to be awash in it, right? All these new technologies and so forth, finding it all over the place now.
Yeah. Well, world oil inventories are like at record levels. There's like 2 months of oil sitting around just in commercial inventories. Our strategic reserve is chock-a-block full. There's excess production all over the world. For the last 2 years, world oil demand has dropped for the first time since the 1980s. U.S. gasoline demand is down for the second year. It was down like 3% last year. This is unheard of. World demand is falling off a cliff, except in China. But here's the thing. The Chinese numbers are dubious at best, and what it now looks like is that a lot of the crude they've been buying has been going into strategic storage because I think they're worried about a cutoff at some point in the event that push comes to shove with the United States.
Well, let's step back a moment. You know, we're talking about the Chinese versus the rest of the world dynamic from these resources point of view. You know, we talk often about elites and so forth. Certainly China is ruled by an authoritarian, if not totalitarian, elite. And, you know, the elites that run our part of the world have been pretty used to China being a tired old man, you know, bum practically, sleeping. I don't mean to disparage China and the Chinese. I'm just trying to come up with an analogy. All of a sudden, China's waking up to be you know, Charles Atlas, it seems.
Well, this is not all of a sudden. If you go back and look at some of Bill Clinton's comments when he was in the White House back in the mid-90s, he was utterly preoccupied with what the Chinese were doing. He was extremely concerned about it, and he should have been, because in the early 90s, U.S. policy was basically to be treat the Chinese as, you know, nice Mr. Doberman, you know, let's all get along nice. We got them most favored nation trading status. We got them into the World Trade Organization eventually. We thought we could all coexist. But what you find is that the Chinese lie, cheat, and steal when it comes to trade. They violate all the rules with impunity. They channel much of the wealth they create into their military buildup, which is going on at a breakneck pace. And everybody knows that sooner or later the Chinese and the United States are going to come eyeball to eyeball over the Pacific somewhere. Maybe it'll be Taiwan, maybe it'll be something else, but at some point that's going to happen. The Chinese thought they had maybe 20 years starting in the early 90s to prepare for that point. And the point I make in the book is that it looks like even at the end of Clinton's administration, and certainly during the Bush years, the object was to slow down the Chinese, and one way you do that is to raise the cost of all their industrial inputs, crude oil, iron ore, bauxite, all that kind of stuff. When you look at the Chinese economy overall, they make no money. Their industrial plants are basically break even when you deduct the amount of bad loans that they've got hanging over them. So China, you can make a strong case that China is a house of cards run by a very tiny political elite, a brittle system that could be busted apart if you put enough stress on it. And that's what the Chinese are apoplectic about. They're absolutely deathly afraid of large unemployment levels. That's why they keep their currency too low. They force exports on the rest of the world, and they brutally suppress any slight outbreak of civil unrest there.
And they also keep a very, very tight control over technology like Google and so forth, because they don't want to see any kind of Twitter revolutions going on either, right?
Right. No,
which they'd be very vulnerable to, I would think.
The Chinese and the U.S. are already neck deep in an economic war. And that's the only way to understand the yammering over currency rates, interest rates, trade levels, and, you know, the internet technology stuff is all part of that.
Jim, you know, to the extent that you've analyzed this thing, this is like I've told our audience, this is something we're going to be focusing on for them because we really need to look at this thing. You know, to the uninitiated, it seems like China is the one holding all the cards rather than being a house of cards. We owe them so much money, and they've got so many people, and they haven't brought their military totally online yet to be a world empire, to world empire status yet. But they certainly have the people. They certainly have the capacity to build it up to that. Why shouldn't that be the case?
Well, they are on a trajectory to, I mean, they're rapidly improving their strategic forces. They've added submarine nuclear ballistic missiles. They're greatly increasing their navy. They've added more strategic missile launchers, decoy sites, mobile launchers. So they've made themselves relatively immune to a first strike threat by the United States. China is definitely... Plus, they've demonstrated anti-satellite capability, which can, you know, that's akin to anti-ballistic missile technology. So they're rapidly moving ahead to the point. You see, the object is get themselves to a point where they don't have to back down if they are confronted by the United States at some point, say, over Taiwan or whatever.
Which, by the way, is brewing right now, isn't it?
That's right. And, you know,
sails to Taiwan right now.
The United States' decision to sell arms to Taiwan, this is not some off-the-cuff decision. It's been working in the works for a while, and I think the United States probably senses the Chinese have some vulnerability at this point, and there may be a limited window of opportunity to basically challenge them on this.
Certainly a quick way to take the temperature, isn't it?
That's right.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to see a steadily ratcheting up of tension between the United States and China, and between Japan and China as well. You know, Japan and India have just signed a new defense accord, trade agreements. What you see is the United States basically encircling China again with trade and military agreements. We've basically tilted heavily towards India against China, and
probably has a lot to do with why we're in Afghanistan, to
exactly.
Sort of circle around the bottom end there and prevent any kind of access down to the sea.
It's all about China containment and Tying Pakistan away from the Chinese orbit.
Yeah. Now, it seems to me, you know, when the Chinese say that, when you say, or when the U.S. looks at the Chinese as a bunch of liars and cheaters and thieves and so forth, Why shouldn't China view the U.S. and Britain, for instance, the same way after their experience? And why shouldn't they?
Well, look, we just have more and better lawyers and accountants than the Chinese do, so we can, you know, get away with this stuff better. We're much more practiced at this trade game than the Chinese are, but you know they're getting there.
It's might makes right. That's what it's been, and China has been at the brunt of that for a very long time. Why now? How do we climb down from that position, or is that going to be the thing straight on out until we get eyeball to eyeball with the Chinese, and then what happens? Well, why don't we get your ideas about that, Jim, on the other side of the break here. We're talking with James Norman about China, the United States, and particularly through oil. We'll be back with him just after this.
America, you are being tested, but here's where we study for it. From 1/2 mile north of Ground Zero in New York City, you are listening to INN World Report Radio with Tom Kiley. Now, daily on GCN, 4 until 5 p.m. Central. For 9 years, the alternative media activists at INN have produced national daily television news and information programming top of the hour radio news briefs, and INN World Report Radio. News talk radio that brings you real news the networks won't tell you, and all of it 100% certified neocon free. To find out more and for details on the stories we are following, go to INNWorldReport.net.
America's number one source for independent talk radio for over a decade. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Good friends, welcome back. This is Tom Kiley, INN World Report Radio. We come to you 5 days a week right here on the great GCN Radio Network, 4 until 5 p.m. Central Time, where INN dedicates itself to bringing you news the networks won't tell you. And if the networks are blathering about something, and it happens to be what we're focusing on as well, you can bet that we will bring it to you from a perspective that they're not allowed to talk about, or they haven't thought of, or take your pick. Anyhow, in that spirit, we're having a very, very interesting conversation, and it's clear that we're going to have author Jim Norman back on with us, James Norman, in the near future, because we're only just kind of scratching the surface here. For the next couple of days, friends, we're going to be focusing on U.S.-China and resources and so forth, and he's written just a great book about it, The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century, all about how economic warfare seems to be much more effective these days than flat-out military and conventional warfare when it comes at least to very large power centers around the world. James, on that subject, I want to touch on Russia, too, because that's a very interesting balance tipper, perhaps, in this equation, maybe not. But before we do that, what about the impact on the American citizen? You know, when oil prices were cheap, because according to your thesis, we wanted to break the back of the old Soviet Union. I think people, you know, really took advantage of that. They bought clunkers, they bought Hummers and Humvees and that kind of thing. Now it's the other way around. It's like everyone's being called back into the army to fight the Chinese, and we're suffering like crazy at the pump. What is the impact? Do you think there's any consideration for the impact on the American citizen, this type of economic warfare?
Well, the point I make in the book is that oil prices have been used as an economic weapon. We drove them down against the Russians in the 1980s. We've been driving them up against the Chinese, who are importers. How you do that, if you're the government, it's actually not that hard to do. We're quite well practiced at it. And one key element was to drive down oil demand in the 80s. How did we do that? Long after the price of oil peaked and was heading way down, in the mid-80s, we came in with these draconian fuel economy standards. People weren't buying Hummers back in the 80s. They were force-fed compact cars. And U.S. gasoline demand fell dramatically in the 80s, and it didn't recover for 20 years. Now, gasoline demand is falling again. And the problem that the government is going to have, ultimately, is keeping the price up. And the way the book notes you can do that is by throwing lots of money at the futures market, which makes up for the lack of physical demand for the product. You can create a huge amount of paper demand for oil in the futures market, and you'll see that the amount of money sloshing into the commodity markets is almost back to the peak of where it was in the middle of 2008 when oil prices peaked. So I would expect crude prices are going to remain very strong for a while. Although, you see, gasoline is actually not that bad right now. Fuel oil for your home heating is cheap, relatively. The refiners are taking it in the shorts with very poor refining margins right now. So you can manage all these things.
How long can you play that futures game, though? I mean, the future is going to get here sooner or later. I mean, you know, how long does that go, trying to speculate, pump it up?
You see, what you do with this, the way the futures market works is you basically pull in a bunch of money from huge government pension funds and stuff like that. They allocate a portion of their portfolio to commodities. They go through Goldman Sachs or some other swaps dealer. They turn it into futures contracts. You buy a contract way out on the curve somewhere, and as it matures, you sell it, and then you roll it over. You keep that money churning in there in that market so that you're continually bidding up the high end of the market. And then even if you lose some money in there, the net effect that you get of keeping the price up accomplishes your purpose. So the futures market is a key ingredient there. And I go into that more in the book. It's too complex to explain here, I think.
Well, maybe we can have you on next week so we can continue if you're going to be in town or you're going to be by a phone, because I would like to continue this conversation with you. However, I also want to get your take on Russia. Now, Russia has large oil reserves. That's why, according to your thesis, the price was driven down. Now that that's been accomplished, the Soviet Union has had its back broken. They're making out pretty good right now with the price so high?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're doing quite well. Not as good as they were at $140 oil, but they're surviving. And, in fact, the point I would make is that the reason we're keeping oil at these levels in the 70 to 80 price bracket is because if it falls much below that, Russia is in deep crud. They would have a severe banking problem, currency crisis, capital outflows, and we don't want those guys to collapse. As much as we dislike Mr. Putin and his crowd, we don't want a vacuum there. And so, plus, we're at a delicate point right now where we want the Russians on board as far as Iran sanctions. We need them to cooperate here, and we don't want them to just fall of necessity into the Chinese orbit here. Now, the Chinese and the Russians have gotten quite cozy lately. In fact, the Russians have built a huge oil pipeline into China, which the Chinese have been clamoring for decades. But the volumes are rather small, and the Chinese have to pay up through the nose for that crude as well. And they could turn off the spigot if they ever had to. So Russia is kind of a variable in this game here.
Well, also, though, what about the Russian situation? It seems like this is about the only thing they have going for themselves, right? I mean, it kind of looks like
right.
You know, the Beverly Hillbillies have struck it rich and they're just spending it and they're not investing it wisely. Is that a fair assessment? I don't mean to disparage Russia, but it doesn't. What are they doing?
Not a great hand, but they have crude to export. That's their main source of hard currency earnings. It was true in the 80s, too. That's why we attacked their crude prices as a way to defeat them. And we bankrupted the Soviet Union by the late 80s. They just collapsed. They couldn't pay their bills, and they just went away. Since then, since the prices come up, they really have not plowed that money back into their manufacturing capacity. The Russians still don't make anything worth selling abroad except crude oil. And so they're still woefully dependent on crude exports and other raw materials. And that means they're vulnerable to to commodity market pricing. They're really a very weak state. They don't have a strong hand to play.
It's interesting that you stray from the orthodoxy that Ronald Reagan drove them out of business by pumping up the defense budget and so forth. And I remember when the Berlin Wall came down, I remember Poppy Bush giving a speech where in the same speech he's claimed that who could have ever imagined this would happen in our lifetime. And at the other end of the speech, he took credit for it with Ronald Reagan. that's a pretty good trick, isn't it?
The bust the Russian strategy was in place from day one when Reagan took office, and I would imagine even before that. And there was a whole string of things, which I know in the book. The way we drove down the price of oil and kept it down for a decade or more until those guys were kaput. It's not that hard to do. Again, we used the NYMEX, the futures market, in reverse. We threw lots of paper barrels onto the market and drove the price down.
As a matter of fact, very interesting in your book, you say that the timing of the creation of the NYMEX market itself is very interesting in this story, isn't it? Why don't you talk about that for a minute?
I'm glad you caught that. That's true. I mean, the NYMEX came out of nowhere. It was like a failed potatoes futures market at the time. Suddenly it was given the rights to trade crude oil futures, which it basically soon took the entire market away from the so-called wet barrel traders in Houston, the guys who thought that they owned the crude market. All of a sudden, the price was not being set in Houston. It was being set in New York on this potatoes futures exchange. And part of the way they did it, you know, we know it in the book, the key player at that time was a guy named John Joyce, who was largely reputed to have been a CIA connection somewhere.
So there you go. How many talk show hosts do you speak to who have picked up that little detail there, huh?
Not many. Good work.
There you go. Well, good work for your great, great book. We've been talking with James Norman, and I've been giving the book away, friends. Tomorrow, first caller tomorrow, I'll get a copy. I'll send it off to you. The Oil Card, Global Economic Warfare in the 21st Century. James, we only got started on this. It's a fascinating subject. What do you say we have you back maybe even as soon as next week? You game?
Yeah, I'm around. Sure.
That'll be great. Is there a website or something people can go to?
There is. I haven't updated it for a while. It's theoilcard.com, all one word.
Very good. Theoilcard.com. And you can find out all about this great book by James R. Norman. Friends, we'll be back with you tomorrow. We're going to continue talking about China then.